My friends, welcome to this special bonus episode of the Bible Project Daily Podcast. I'm just taking the opportunity to upload these bonus episodes over the next few days while I am working on my preparation for our next season, the Book of Numbers. That work's progressing well, and I've prepared the sort of the outline of the whole series, and it looks like it's going to be between 35 to 40 days we'll spend working through the entire book before then, of course, returning again to the New Testament. So during this time, I'm taking the opportunity to upload a few bonus episodes. Now, the one you're going to hear today is my Christian response to a philosophic dialogue by Plato called Crito. Now, this is actually a recording of my study notes I used in a philosophy discussion group that I attended on the 2nd of May 2023, which I recorded the following morning after that discussion group. It's based on my notes of preparation and what I said that evening. It was originally released as a bonus episode for my Patreon community just a little over a year ago. Patreon's the place where those people who want to connect more closely with the ministry, and some of whom who indeed support it through that platform, it's the place where I put bonus episodes. And this is the sort of thing that you'll find over there. So if you'd like to have access to that exclusive bonus material, the stuff that doesn't directly fit into the Bible Project Daily Podcast, you'll find it over there. Anyway, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll see you in a few days when we launch off together on the Book of Numbers. Bye-bye for now. Hello, friends. Welcome to a bonus episode, Something New. Some of you may know that every couple of weeks I attend a philosophy group, a group of some very bright people, a lot of people a lot brighter than me, meet together every couple of weeks, and we discuss and address a famous philosopher or a famous or an important work by a famous philosopher. There's an opportunity for us all to study it beforehand, prepare, and everybody's given an opportunity to speak. The basis of this week's study was a book by, I'm sure you've heard of him, a philosopher called Plato, and something he wrote called Crito, which in a nutshell deals with the trial and execution of his mentor, Socrates. And also, in a sort of apologetic, discusses the whole idea of how being a citizen of a state makes us party to a contract within the state unless we choose to sort of move out of it. And in a sense that no one has the right to refute that. Each week we have one of those meetings. I spend nearly a full day preparing myself for what's going to be discussed that evening. My whole purpose of attending those meetings is to try and bring a Christian lean, a focus on how these great minds throughout history do not contradict a reasonable belief in the Bible being the revelation of God. So what I'm just going to do today is share for you my notes in preparation of this and some of what I said at that meeting. And I'm going to make these available for time to time as bonus episodes here just for my patrons. So a little bit of background on Socrates himself, the person about whom Plato is writing and the events around it. Now, Socrates himself, around whom these events all take place, was actually the son of a sculptor and a midwife. And when he was a young boy, he lived during the rise to power of someone called Pericles. And it brought on what was referred to as many as the dawn of the golden age of Greece. Now, as a young man, Socrates himself witnessed that power shift as Pericles, as the head of the city-state, acted on his belief that all the masses, not just the property-owning aristocrats, deserved a degree of freedom and a sense of autonomy and influence. Pericles created the people's courts and used the public treasury to promote the arts. He pushed ahead with an unprecedented building program designed not only to demonstrate the glory that was indeed Greece, but also to ensure full employment and to provide opportunities for wealth creation among those non-propertied and ruling classes. During that time, you see the rebuilding of the Acropolis and the construction of the Parthenon, And these are two of the best known of Pericles's many, many ambitious building projects, but we can still in fact see those two massive structures still standing today. However, as he grew into childhood, Socrates somehow developed a set of values and beliefs that would put him at odds with most of his fellow Athenians. To him, the people could not be self-governing. They were like a herd of sheep. He thought they needed direction and the direction of a wise shepherd. That's an interesting term from a Christian perspective. He actually denied that the citizens had the basic, what he called, virtues, and that's an important concept when it comes to Greek philosophy, that they lacked the virtues necessary to nurture a good society. Now, he equated the idea of virtue with knowledge, and of course knowledge was unobtainable by most ordinary people in that day. So striking at the heart of the Athenian democracy, Socrates scornfully criticised the right of all these citizens to even speak in the Athenian assembly. Often his unpopular views were expressed very disdainfully and with an open air of condescension, really ridiculing his listeners and often provoking them to anger. The standing of Socrates among his fellow citizens suffered greatly during the two-year period into which the Athenian democracy was temporarily overthrown, one in a four-month period and another in a several-year period, both of those overthrows happening between 411 and 403 BC. What was not helpful from Socrates' point of view is the fact that both of these anti-democratic movements were initiated by former pupils of Socrates, and of course the Athenians undoubtedly considered the teaching of Socrates, especially his expression of disdain for the established constitution, well, they considered it that he was in fact partly responsible for the resulting death and suffering. The horrors brought on by these events caused Athenians to look at Socrates in a new way. His teachings no longer seemed to be harmless intellectual musings. His logic came to be seen as dangerous and a corrupting influence in the real world and the potential breeder of tyrants and future enemies of the Athenian state and the common man. So, this event, the trial, which would eventually lead to the execution of Socrates, occurred in Athens in 399 BC. Now, to a degree, his actual death has some aspects of it have puzzled historians. They asked the question that why in a society that was enjoying freedom and this early expression of democracy, more freedom than any other society in the world had ever known up to that point, why would they want to put a 70-year-old philosopher to death for basically what he was saying? The puzzle is all the more curious because Socrates had been able to teach without any problems for all of his adult life. What could it be that Socrates had said or done that prompted a jury of 500 of his fellow Athenians to actually sentence him to death at the age of 70? Well, finding an answer to that is rather a mysterious and complicated issue. And the fact is, we only have two surviving accounts of the defence given by Socrates, and both of them come from disciples of his. This one we're looking at today, Plato in Crito, and another one by Xenophon. And as I say, it's Plato and his account that we're looking at particularly today, and it is that which we discussed and studied together at the Philosophy Society attended. What appears almost certain is that the decision to prosecute and ultimately convict Socrates in reality had to do with the turbulent history of Athens that had been going through in the years immediately preceding his trial. An examination of the events in Athens at that time may provide us with some important clues. So let's just give you a little bit of an overview of this trial of Socrates that Plato's reporting on. In Athens at that time, criminal proceedings could be initiated by any citizen. In the case of Socrates, the proceedings began when Meletus, a poet, delivered an oral summons to Socrates in the presence of witnesses, as was the normal format of doing that. A preliminary hearing before the magistrate said that there was merit in the accusation made against him, and thereby formal charges were drawn up. The subsequent trial took place over a 10-hour period, one day, long day, in the People's Court, located in the Agora, the civic centre in the middle of Athens. The jury, as I said, consisted of 500 male citizens, all over the age of 30, chosen by lot, which ironically included a 27-year-old pupil of Socrates, the forenamed Plato, whose account in the form of this apologetic called Crito is what we are studying and talking about today. Now, apparently dozens of accounts of the three-hour speech given in his defence by Socrates did actually exist at one time, but today we only have Plato and Xenophon's accounts. They're the only ones that survive. But these two accounts do agree on all the key points, and that being that Socrates actually gave a very defiant, decidedly unapologetic defence of his position. Plato's version of Socrates, as I said, is called Crito, and it shows him confrontationally telling his jury that he is in fact a hero, not an enemy. He reminds them of his exemplary service as what was called a hoplite in three battles in the Peloponnesian War. He also states that he has battled for decades to save the souls of the Athenians by pointing them in the direction of trying to lead an ethical life, one that could be put under the spotlight and examined and measured. According to Plato, Socrates actually tells the jury that he would rather be put to death than to give up what he saw as the work of God saving souls. Plato, quoting from Socrates' defence, says he said this, "Men of Athens, I honour and I love you, but I shall obey God rather than you, and while I have life and strength, I shall never cease from the practice and teaching of philosophy." Now, after the conviction of Socrates, by a relatively close vote, the defendant was given an opportunity to propose a punishment, as was the pattern that day. After listening to the arguments, the jurors would then normally choose which of the two proposed punishments that should be adopted. The accusers of Socrates proposed that the punishment should be death. In proposing death, the accusers would have expected it to have been countered with a proposal, perhaps for exile, a punishment that probably would have satisfied both them and the jury. But Socrates refused to make a reasonable or a realistic counter-suggestion as to what his punishment would be. So then in the final vote, an even larger majority of the jurors voted in favour of the punishment of death. According to Diogenes, in the end, 360 jurors voted for death and 141 for a fine. Under Athenian law, execution was accompanied by the drinking of a cup of poisoned hemlock. The hemlock that ended his life would not have done so quickly or painlessly, but would rather have produced initially some pain followed by a gradual paralysis of the central nervous system. Most scholars see the conviction and execution of Socrates as a deliberate choice he made, one that the famous philosopher set before himself. And if the accounts of Plato and Xenophon are to be reasonably accurate, Socrates then did not even seek to persuade the jurors, rather he took the opportunity to lecture them more, and some say even provoke them and turn more of them against him. Thereby, this trial of Socrates has become one of the most interesting suicide-stroke-martyrdoms. Had he wanted to, Socrates could probably have won an acquittal. The closeness of the vote shows that there was nothing inevitable about his sentence. If he had been less confrontational, less arrogant, if he had argued that he was just exercising his basic right of free speech, a right of which the Athenians were really proud, then the jurors might have been more receptive. But he was uncompromising. He made the decision, as a matter of personal integrity, that he would make the Athenians choose between their love of freedom and their love of community, and in the end, they chose community, the city-state. The manner in which he chose to die sort of enhanced his reputation among his associates and made him, in a sense, a great martyr for the cause of free speech. Many view him still today as a sort of secular saint. As historian I.F. Stone observed, just as Jesus needed the cross to fulfil his mission, Socrates, in a sense, needed hemlock to fulfil his. Okay, so that's the background. So now we come to this dialogue by Plato called Crito.
Hi, this is Ashley T. Lee Podcast. Join me to hear the Bible read line by line and clearly explained. Listen to the Word of God in your car or home or work while it transforms your mind daily. Romans 12:2 says, "Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, which is good and acceptable and perfect." Knowing the Bible can give you peace and joy in this hectic world. Listen weekly to Ashley T. Lee Podcast on all podcast sites.
And as a dialogue, it exists to explore the morality and duty of being obedient to the laws of the state, even if they're unjust. In this essay stroke dialogue, Socrates is seen to be faced with the decision of whether or not to escape from prison or to remain and fulfill his death sentence. Crito, a wealthy friend, visits him and offers to help Socrates escape, but Socrates refuses. What I want to do here is approach and analyse this text, this book, Crito, from a Christian perspective, exploring how Socrates' decision relates to Christian teaching on justice, obedience to authority, and the role of the individual in society, and to see how they compare. Now, the Christian perspective on the themes contained within Crito are actually quite numerous and complex. On one hand, the Christian faith, of course, teaches obedience to the law and to the authorities and to the powers that be. But on the other hand, it also upholds the values of justice and righteousness, which may, of course, we see conflict with certain laws and principles that apply in the land. Then there is the whole concept of justice, both Christian teachings and here in this dialogue in Crito. In Crito, Socrates argues that it would be unjust for him to escape from prison as he would be violating the laws of the state. He argues that the state had granted him many benefits through his life, including his very education, and offered him protection. Therefore, he owed the state obedience, even if it meant giving up his life. Socrates believed that true justice requires individuals to fulfil their duties and obligations to the state, even if those duties are difficult or unpopular. Now here we find some common ground with Christianity in that the Christian faith teaches that justice is also closely tied to the obedience of God and his law. The Bible instructs Christians to obey the authorities that God has put in place as they are there to promote justice and maintain order in society. In fact, Paul, writing to the Romans in chapter 13, in the opening verses of chapter 13, states this. He says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, one must be in subjection not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience." So this passage and others underscore the importance of the Christian perspective of obedience to the law as a way of expressing faith in God's sovereignty and his providence. Socrates, however, seemed to be rejecting this notion in his dialogue with Crito, as he refuses to escape and break the law, despite the fact that he is facing, by his own definition, an unjust death sentence. Just as Socrates believed that it is our duty to obey the laws of the state, Christianity does itself, of course, teach that it is also, that it is above all other things, our duty to obey the law of God, whilst at the same time obeying the authorities that he himself has instituted and put in place. One way to reconcile Socrates' stance with the Christian call for obedience to the law is to distinguish between what we would today, as Christian believers, call just and unjust laws. In Acts chapter 5, Peter, the apostle, helpfully declares for us that when it comes to the end of the day, he says we must obey God rather than men when we have that conflict. So in the book of Acts, in that passage, we see there were situations where obeying human authorities may in fact bring us into conflict with obeying God's commandments. Socrates' decision was to accept his unjust death sentence rather than break the law, and that can be seen as a sort of act of faith, an act of faith in the sense that God's justice and sovereignty would win through in the end. But by submitting to the authorities, Socrates is also believed that he was submitting to God's will, even if it involved his own personal suffering and injustice. He had such a heightened view of the law of God, the logos of God, being institutionalized, if you like, within the city-state. Another theme in Crito is obedience to authority. Socrates throughout it argues that it is necessary to obey the law of the states, even if they change, in order, if nothing else, to maintain order and to prevent chaos. He believes that disobedience to the state would actually lead to anarchy and harm the greater good of everyone in that society. And Socrates also argues that it is unjust to disobey the laws of the state because they have been put in place by the people and it has not been created by individuals. It is not up for individuals to decide which laws to obey and which to disobey. Now, Christianity also emphasizes obedience to authority, suggesting that we too are to submit to authority at all sorts of levels of society, including within our families, our parents, at work, our employers, even within the faith community, our church leaders. In fact, Paul, in his writing to the Colossians, says this: "Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance of your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ." So this verse suggests that the obedience to authority is not just about fulfilling duty, but it is also can be part of serving God. Christians therefore are called to submit to an authority as an act of obedience and worship to God. Socrates' decision to accept his death sentence may be seen as a form of civil disobedience, because he is in fact protesting against the injustice of his trial and his sentence. However, unlike modern forms of civil disobedience, Socrates' protest is not directed at specific law or politics, but at the entire Athenian system of justice and politics. Socrates, in a sense, argues that the Athenians have not, in fact, lived up to their own standards of justice, and are therefore these standards are unworthy of his obedience. He also suggests that it was his duty to continue questioning and challenging authority through his philosophy, even if that meant for him facing persecution and death. Now, the Christian perspective on civil obedience is very complex and nuanced. On one hand, you see the Bible teaches obedience to the authorities, as I mentioned earlier. However, it also upholds the value of justice and righteousness, which as principles may sometimes conflict with certain law and certainly politics and policies. Christians have been in history both proponents and opponents of civil disobedience, depending on the context and the principles at stake at the time. Ultimately, the decision of whether or not to engage in civil disobedience as a Christian should be based on a careful assessment of the ethical principles involved and how they then line up with the scriptural revelation of, i.e. the Word of God, and the potential consequences that those decisions will have, not only to ourselves but to others. The Christian concept of justice is closely related to the themes of obedience to the law and the law of God. So where does civil disobedience sit in with this? Justice lies at the heart in that it is the principle of fairness and equity in human relationships and interactions, whether between individuals, communities, or nations. Justice is a core value in the Bible, as exemplified in passages such as Micah 6:8, which states, "He has told you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God." Socrates' critique of Athenian justice system in this work could be interpreted as a call for a higher standard of justice, one that is based on reason and virtue, rather than just the power or prejudices of the ordinary people. Socrates argues that the Athenians have failed to live up to their own standards of justice, as demonstrated by the very events of his unfair, unjust trial and sentence. He also suggests that justice is not a matter of personal preference or opinion, but a universal principle that applies to all human beings. From a Christian perspective, Socrates' critique of Athenian justice can be seen as a pre-biblical affirmation of the very biblical values imprinted within the earliest revelations of justice and righteousness. The Bible teaches that these values are from God and therefore are not limited to a specific culture or a time period, but they apply to all human beings across all times, regardless of their nationality or belief. And they represent, in a sense, a universal moral order. Socrates, by calling for a higher standard of justice on one level, in a sense he may have believed he was attempting to dismantle the Athenian state, but Socrates, by calling for a higher standard of justice, was interpreted by the people to mean that he was attempting to dismantle the Athenian state. What he was doing in reality was actually calling for a higher standard of morality, to constantly renew and replace the old ideas with something better, one that he actually believed was rooted in God, God's characters and God's standard. And then there is also another theme in Crito, and that is the theme of individual responsibility. Socrates argued that an individual had a duty to fulfil their responsibilities to the state, even if it meant sacrificing their own interests or desires. Socrates also believed that it was not the place of individuals to decide which laws are just and unjust, but rather to obey the law that had been put in place by the state. This duty to the state is greater than the duty to oneself, and individuals must be willing to make sacrifices for the good of the society. So at one and the same time, it seems he could argue against the application or the truth of what the society believed and instituted at that time, whilst at the same time recognising that the higher position he must take morally was to accept the judgment of that society that it made through the proper processes at that time. Now, similarly, Christianity teaches that as individuals, we are also have a responsibility. In fact, we're called by God to serve others and live sacrificially. But our type of living sacrificially takes on a totally different tone. In Matthew, Jesus is seen to tell his disciples, "Whoever would be great among you must be the servant, and whoever would be first amongst you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Christianity, in fact, teaches that the greatest act of love is to sacrifice oneself for others. Now, in a way, that's what Socrates probably believed he was doing. But in his case, I would suggest that it was a narrow perspective, for he was sacrificing for the greater good of the society in which he lived, which in his case was the Athenian city-state. So in conclusions, it seems to me that this work, Crito by Plato, in exploring the themes of justice and obedience to authority and individual responsibility, those things that we see Socrates argue in it, that all means that it is necessary, ultimately, fundamentally, at the end of the day, is to always obey the laws of the state, even when they're unjust, in order to maintain order and to prevent chaos, because the very state will benefit from it. Now, in a similar way, but different, Christianity teaches, yes, it's important to obey the authorities in the sense that God has put these people in place and it is right for the sake of justice and the order of a peaceful society to obey them. And Socrates, along with Christianity, would say that the individual responsibility is always going to be greater in the form of service to other people than our own self-interest, and also that individuals have a duty to make sacrifices for the greater good of other people. So there are clearly similarities here to the Christian teaching on sacrificial love and service to others and what Plato did in the writing of this apologetic called Crito. By doing it, he provides a thought-provoking dialogue on the obedience on themes like obedience to authority and the role of the individual society, things that we're talking about to this day. But the important point of view from a Christian point of view, remember this is 400 years before Christ had even been born, this type of thinking prepares the soil for the future, in a sense, for the planting of the revelation of Christ as the embodiment of the Logos, the living word, a sort of prototype development of Christian ideas of service and sacrifice as sort of played out through the state. So this work, Crito, though presenting as a thought-provoking dialogue between these two people, it actually is something that explores the morality of whether or not you should break the law in the face of injustice. From a Christian point of view, the dialogue raises issues that are important and challenging questions about obedience to the law, whether we should ever take part in civil disobedience, and the concept of justice, and all those things in the light of all the various protest movements and thinking that rise today are still very relevant, aren't they? However, while the Bible clearly teaches there should be obedience to the authorities, it also upholds the values of justice and righteousness, even when they may conflict with certain laws and policies at the time. Ultimately, my friends, the decision to follow the law or to engage in civil disobedience should be based on a careful assessment of the ethical principles involved and the potential consequences for one another, and ultimately what the Word of God directly or indirectly teaches about it. Additionally, the Bible would tell us that the Christian concept of justice must be understood as a universal principle that applies to all human beings, which should be held up even in the face of persecution and injustice. For me, Plato's analysis of Socrates' trial, the work that we've been looking at, is a useful gateway for looking at Plato's philosophy itself. Plato's thought has been studied and analysed extensively for its huge contribution to the development of Western philosophy generally. However, there are some real weaknesses in Plato's philosophy that I think we can point out perspective. The three main areas of weakness are, for me, they are in his understanding of the nature of the physical world, his views on the soul and the afterlife, and his understanding of the nature of God. Firstly, Plato's philosophy is characterized by something called dualism, a dualism that exists between the physical world and what he called the world of ideas. Plato believed the physical world was in fact a mere shadow of the real world of ideas that lay behind it, or lay before it, I suppose would be a better way of describing it, as the physical world is the shadow of it. This dualism can be problematic from a Christian perspective, as it creates a division between the physical and the spiritual realm that is not really present in Christian thought. In Christianity, the physical world is not seen as inferior or less important than the spiritual world. In fact, the two belong together. In fact, the Christian belief in the resurrection of the body emphasizes the importance of the physical reality. The physical world is seen in Christianity as a creation of God, and as such is good. And this is in contrast to Plato's view of the physical world, which is a mere imitation of the world of ideas. Furthermore, Plato's dualism can lead to a devaluation of the physical world and of our own physical bodies. Plato actually believed that the body was a hindrance to the soul, and that the ultimate goal of human life was to escape the body and ascend to what he believed was basically a world of ideas. This view is very problematic from a Christian perspective, because it can lead to not only the neglect of the physical world and our stewardship of it, but a disregard for the value of caring for the human being, the human body, both our own and other people's. You see, in contrast, in Christianity, the body is seen as the temple of the Holy Spirit, and as such, it is to be respected and cared for and held in a degree of esteem. And also, we've got to say Plato's view on the soul is also very problematic for Christians. Plato believed that the soul is immortal and that it existed before the body and will continue to exist after the body dies. Now, this view on the surface appears similar, but it is contradicted when you look at it closely by the Christian belief in the resurrection of the body, because Christianity teaches that the soul and body will ultimately be inseparable, and that the ultimate goal of human life is not escape of this body into some sort of airy-fairy spirituality, but to actually be resurrected with a glorified body, just like Christ before us. Plato's belief in the mortality of the soul itself can also lead to a neglect of the physical world and a focus on the afterlife. The expression "too heavenly minded to be any earthly good" comes to mind. Plato believed that the ultimate goal of human life was the attainment of knowledge and an understanding of this world of ideas as he saw it, and it was that that would prepare you for the afterlife. This, of course, limits it to those who have the intellectual capacity to travel that road. But also this focus on the afterlife can lead to a neglect of the spiritual life and a disregard for the whole physical world and, more importantly, of other people. Plato also believed that the soul was superior to the body and that the body was, as I said before, a fact, a hindrance to the journey of the soul. In Christianity, the body and the soul are intimately connected, and the body is seen as good, made by God and good, and a necessary part of our human existence. And finally, Plato's understanding of the nature of God himself is very problematic from a Christian perspective. Plato believed that God is the highest form of good, and the ultimate goal in life is to attain knowledge, albeit, as he would say, knowledge of God. However, this view of God is completely different from the Christian understanding of God as a person, as a personal, loving God who is intimately involved in the lives of those who loved him, and the fact that that love that we have for him is simply a response to his love for us, which he showed us first before we even knew or cared about him. In Christianity, God is definitely not just merely an abstract concept or a high ideal to be in for, but he is a personal God, which means we can know him personally, which means we can speak to him, and that he will respond and speak to us and on occasion intervene in our life when our will is in line with his will. And most importantly, that he revealed himself fully to humanity through Jesus Christ. The Christian understanding of God emphasizes God's love for humanity and his desire to have a personal relationship with each individual. And that understanding of God, frankly, is not present in the ideas of the Greek philosophers, acted as a sort of fertile soil in which the message of Christianity could be planted and thereby spread and grow. It was, in my estimation, an important starting point and an enabling and transition of the God of the Old Testament as revealed in the Word and the sacrificial system to a new salvation plan revealed through the New Covenant in the New Testament of a personal relationship and repentance through Christ, the Son of God. Okay, that's it. Thank you. It's good to know that there is a reasonable response and a way of looking at these things. And it isn't ridiculous to believe that God, the God of the Bible, through the person of Jesus, is someone that can be known personally. Thank you for joining me, and I'll see you again sometime soon. Bye-bye now.